Well, I want to say thank you to this extremely outstanding panel for all of the wisdom that you have shared with us. I'm particularly appreciative of the fact that three out of the four are women brings a whole different pattern of issues to the table. I wish I had been hearing these issues when I started my career. I would have done things a little differently, just a little differently. Do we have any questions? Yes. Where did it go? Oh, there it is.
I feel like I'm on American Idol. But I cannot sing, so don't worry. Okay. My name is Alfie Breland Noble. I'm an assistant professor at the Medical Center at Duke. My question, let me make it short because I can run my mouth. Doctors Toppelberg and Cooley, I know your work, so I know that you have some interest in race and culture, nationality, so on and so forth. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you integrate those interests? They are scientific. How do you integrate those interests with science such that people can appreciate the significance of both in your work, if my question makes sense?
Well, I think it's important in this day and age, and I think with Claudia's presentation, everybody understands that the ethnic and racial demographic changes in this country. And so I think it's not as hard as it once was in terms of having samples, doing work that's representative of the populations that we're interested in. And by demonstrating that, whatever your question is, it's relevant and generalizable, then it's you can make the case that it's good science. And so I don't, Alfie, you know, everybody's question should be appropriate for the population of children, whether it's American children that we're primarily focusing on. And so race, culture, and ethnicity, I justify it by saying that what the interventions that we do are culturally and contextually relevant. And it's important to take existing interventions and making sure that they're appropriate for the populations with which you work. So it's good science, and that's what you're trying to prove. And I think Hector made the point when we were sitting next to each other in terms of the slides that were presented in terms regarding the priority areas, and we had gender and we had age, and obviously missing to us was race and ethnicity. And so I think what's important in terms of the priority areas, if you look at the NIH priorities, that those are consistent. Race and culture and ethnicity are consistent with that.
You also can't translate most of the types of research that's been done to the larger population from a public health standpoint without that type of information, because the population is so diverse. So we have to address that issue as part of good public policy.
You know, I think at the risk of sounding like a broken record, what I find myself doing all the time is repeating the statistics about the number, for instance, of immigrant children, Hispanic children, how many children are bilingual in this country, how many children are bilingual in the world, how many children are immigrant in the world, how little we know about other children. And if you read my empirical publications, every introduction has a whole section trying to nail down the same facts. Now, that's pretty boring for me to be spending time doing that all the time. But I feel I have to do it. It's part of a price. In fact, I'm not particularly interested in describing these populations only, and that's kind of the boring part, and it seems boring for everyone. At the same time, there is such a huge need that we cannot do anything on immigrant populations in particular, for instance, if we don't know what they look like, you know, in many ways. But really what keeps me going is the fact that because I'm a scientist and I'm interested in understanding why things are happening, my understanding that looking at these populations will certainly help these populations in the sense that we will understand what is going on with them, but it also is going to contribute to our understanding of all child populations.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
My name is Zewe Serpel. I'm an assistant professor at James Madison University. And I had a question about sort of that anybody can answer around selecting a mentor and the issue of whether your primary mentor has to be at your institution. And if that is the case, if you have a very, you need actually to rely on somebody who's not at your institution, and whether you can balance that. And a related point, a related question was, in choosing your primary mentor, do you predetermine what your conceptual framework is going to be?
I'd like to address the first point about whether the mentor needs to be where you're located, and this certainly has come up through my work with in the academy. I know very few people, I'd say other people can disagree with this, who have been successful with a mentor who's not on site. I think that would be, I mean, it's speaking for myself, and obviously I've been working with Adrian for many years, our offices are down the hall from each other. So you can formally put together a mentorship plan, but it's ongoing every day. If I have a question, I go in, I give them a call, you know, we sit down and look at the data together, and I think it would be very, I think it'd be too easy for you to get lost without that. And that was what I was saying. I think this always comes up with child psychiatrists and my who want to do research and they don't have someone there. I think you have to move. I mean, if you're really serious about it and that's really what you want to do, I think you have to go somewhere where you can find that.
Well, I also think, though, you know, I know you were talking about also part of the K Award, you have a mentor team. So I think that besides having, you know, your primary mentor, so for example, I have David Barlow as my primary mentor, and he is right next door to my office. So again, I agree with you. We're right, and it really helps that dialogue, and that I would think the true meaning of really a mentorship model really is happening for us. But also, you know, his specialty is more in adults and in anxiety and etiology of anxiety, and my interests are in child. So I had to choose some mentors that weren't located in the Boston area, that were Sheila Iberg, Tom Ollendick, Anne-Marie Albano, people who are located in other parts of the country who could then supplement my mentorship in other areas. And I think it's nice to be able to create a team then and to be able to consult with others that are part of that team.
Helen gets the last word. No, I just wanted to say, I think we didn't touch upon something that I think at another point we can talk about, which is the challenge of going from being a mentee to a colleague. And we really are talking about transition to independent research. And it's a topic for another talk, but it's something that was very painful and challenging, and for me, luckily successful, but a pretty challenging question. So I think that's another thing people can talk about after the meeting.
We have a breakout on that.
Yep, right. Good.
Okay, let's give the panel one more hand. Outstanding guys. Thank you very much.